South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right. Well, a very good morning and pretty Saturday morning out there. It keeps getting a little bit warmer in the mornings. Golly, earlier this week, it was down in the 50s or low 60s. Now we're sitting up there around 70, which is much more typical for this time of year, but still very, very comfortable. Lots and lots of moisture out there. And it's going to get a little warmer this afternoon. So we're just kind of moving along toward what our weather typically is. You notice I never use the word normal when I talk about Texas weather, because I just don't think there's any such thing as normal in our weather. But typically we start warming up about this time of year. By the same token, our landscapes just start blooming and getting entirely more and more and more beautiful if you're doing a few things out there. And I guess that's one of the main things we're here to talk about. So if you've got a question, you know the number, 210-599-5555. David will be up first, and then Tamara, and could be you after that. So give me a call. Lots of things to talk about, but the main thing is what is on your mind, and I hate to keep people waiting. So we'll just go ahead and get started with phone calls. David is up first. Good morning, David.
Morning, Bob.
Morning, sir.
We're still dealing with the effects of Harvey in our St. Augustine, and the weed of the week this week is what I think is dichondra. The one that looks like dollar weed.
Yep, that would make sense, because dichondra is a water lover, and considering that we've had about 3 weeks of off and on rain, I'm not at all surprised that the dichondra is growing vigorously, shall we say.
Yes, it is. So how do we get that under control?
Well, normally, and again, there's that word that I hate to use, but Mother Nature takes care of it as we turn the tap off and things get drier. People who insist on setting their sprinklers to run 3 times a week have an ongoing problem with dichondra. But when we get to that point that we are more dry than wet, when we can do our once a week watering, the dichondra will generally subside and go away. Now, in California, they actually grow it as a lawn. So it's not a noxious invasive weed like dandelions or hembit or some of these other things can be. So my advice is really just mow it and manage it that way, fertilize and keep your basic grafts, healthy and vigorous. And when we start drying out a little bit, the dichondra is going to go away on its own. Now, it is very easily killed with your vinegar and orange oil spray. If you've got areas that are just 100% dichondra and you're not worried about hurting any other grass, 2 ounces of orange oil and a gallon of strong vinegar, that dichondra will be dead in 15 minutes. But that's, kind of like using a shotgun to kill a fly. It's going to it's not really necessary to do a whole lot about it, because it's going to go away on its own as we get into more typical summer weather. So beyond that, if you want to spray for it, if you want to get out and actually just dab the orange oil and vinegar on rather than spray around, or at the very least use a little pump-up sprayer, which about the only kind you can use, but you can very carefully control your spray, and you keep that vinegar and orange oil mix off of your Bermuda, St. Augustine, Zoysia, whatever your basic grass is. You can certainly kill the dichondra very, very easily. But Mother Nature is more than likely going to solve this problem on her own before too long.
Well, spraying's out of the question. St. Augustine is too thick.
Okay.
We've been getting the daily showers in Pasadena, and yep. That makes sense. It's just feeding the problem, so I guess we'll just wait it out.
Yeah, and let your St. Augustine grow a little higher, mow a little bit higher, because dichondra likes to stay low, and St. Augustine will choke it out, if anything. Give it a little more nutrition along the way, but I can think of a whole lot worse problems to have in your yard.
Well, right now, the Honda lawnmower is set at its highest setting, keeping up with the fertilizer. So we're having to mow actually at least 2 times a week. Anyway, okay, Bob, we'll just kind of wait it out then.
Well, it'll this old Texas weather is going to, sooner or later, it's going to go into its summertime pattern. And, you know, for weed purposes, we'd rather it be sooner. For human creature comforts, we'd rather it be later. But it's not a serious problem to worry about, David. So don't feel like you really have to do anything except keep up your good maintenance program that you're already doing.
We're working on it. Thank you, Bob, and have a good one.
You do the same, sir. Thank you for the call. All right. Next up, am I going to pronounce it Tamara or Tamara? How do you pronounce it?
It's Tamara.
Tamara. Well, good morning and welcome. How can I help you this morning?
Good morning. My question is this. I have a pecan tree that's probably over 50 years old in my backyard.
And still a youngster.
Yes. It has shoots coming out of the bottom of the trunk, and the whole top of the tree is totally bare. What would you do with this tree?
And whereabouts do you live?
In Geronimo.
Okay. The first thing I would do, that's not a healthy tree, and that's really not a good sign. When you start seeing a lot of growth from the base, that tells you there's some very serious issues going on. And it could be a number of things. You always, of course, need to check the trunk and be sure that the root flare is exposed. Pecan trees are always or frequently too deeply planted in the ground. This one obviously has been there for a long time, but doesn't mean that soil hasn't piled up around it, which will create problems. There is also the issue of the occasional lightning strike. Sometimes, you will see that a tree's been hit by lightning where the bark is kind of peeled down the side of the tree. Sometimes the bark's blown completely off. Occasionally, there's almost no sign of it, except that the tree sometimes is killed by the heat and by what happens to it. So at this point, I'm going to say cut off the growth at the base of the tree. And our arborist friends are telling us that really don't make any judgments this year till the 4th of July as to what's dead, what's alive, mainly because of the freeze, but also there are other issues out there. I've had some trees, not pecans, but a couple other trees that I thought were completely dead, and I've started getting some growth in the top just in the past 2 weeks. So at this point, I'm not quite ready. I'm going to give the tree another month before I start thinking chainsaw. But it's a tree this size. It's not really practical to say, okay, I'm going to let it regrow from the base, because anything that comes out from there will make a nice big shoot that's very, very weak and probably will break off in the next storm. So at this point, I would trim those basal shoots back and try to encourage the tree to put its efforts into the top of the tree. I give it another month, and if we haven't seen any growth by then, really not a good sign. I have a good arborist come out. I would suggest, and I don't know what you'll find where you are, but there are arborists around that are strictly consulting people who don't have anything to sell you, and that's the guy you can trust most to give you an honest answer. But if you're not seeing some growth in the top of the tree by the 4th of July, it may be gone.
Okay. And that was my second question. There was a flyer in the mailbox yesterday that had it's Arbor Care. It doesn't say that he's an arborist, but it says he's going to be in this area. How do you know if they're a reputable company?
Boy, that's hard to judge. Among other things, they should be certified arborist, but even that's not a guarantee. It's absolutely essential, anyone that you invite onto your property, that you make absolutely certain that they have insurance to protect you, because with the idiot laws we're looking at now, one of their guys falls out of the tree and gets hurt, they can sue you as the homeowner. So every reputable arborist will be happy to provide you with a certificate of insurance for your protection. So those are two things. Beyond that, it's just, I have a series of questions that I ask. I say, well, how do you feel about topping trees? And if they say, oh, we do that sometimes, throw them out. You know, no tree should ever be topped. Ask them, if their focus is on the health of the tree or on the aesthetic qualities of the tree. And if they're just going to trim your tree up to make it pretty, again, that's not what I look for. I look for, you know, a company that is, you know, out to maintain the health of the tree. And if they are one of these companies, a lot of these companies want to charge you a lot of money to fertilize trees. And they talk about deep root injections and things like that that are really not that beneficial. Your tree's used to getting all its nutrients from the surface of the soil. Ask them whether they follow organic practices. Those are the kind of things that I would ask if I were interviewing an arborist. Now, I'm fortunate in that, you know, I've known and used the same arborist for 40 years. But and references from neighbors and friends and people like that, don't hesitate to ask these people for references from work, hopefully in your neighborhood, that you can talk to people about their work. But again, there are people who, and I hear advertisements for them all the time, they want to tell you how beautiful they can make your trees. I want to know how healthy they can keep your trees. And if this tree is indeed dead, you don't need a real specialist. You don't need the best arborist out there. You need somebody that's capable of cutting it down and disposing of the pieces, and definitely has insurance to protect you. I know my business partner inherited a home which had a big dead tree in the backyard. She called a really good arborist and got a quote of $3,000. She called another arborist that we know, well insured and everything else, and he took it down for $500. So again, you don't have to go to the best in the world when what you simply need is removal. But it is still very, very important that you be sure that the people that do the work do have insurance to protect you.
Yes. Okay. All right. Well, that was my question. So thank you very much.
Well, trim those shoots off and keep your fingers crossed. And if you start seeing new growth, further up in the tree, then call me back and we'll talk about additional things to do.
Okay. Okay. Good deal. Thank you so much.
And you have a good Sunday. Thank you for the call this morning.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. All right. There's another open line ready for you to grab. Let's do a little break here, and then we'll come back and take some more phone calls. I get to talk to you about Wild Birds Unlimited. And if you're looking to bring beauty, if you're looking to bring life, if you're looking to bring activity into your yard, well, birding is a really, really fun passion to have. And I mean, watching the hummingbirds this time of year, it's just, you can't help but smile. Watching things like your house finches, your blackback, lesser goldfinches, painted bunnings. I'm thinking of all the things that I've seen around feeder the past few days. There's just a lot of things that you can do to make your backyard into really more of a wildlife sanctuary. And Wild Birds Unlimited, they have everything you need. They have hummingbird feeders with built-in ant stoppers. They have, things come with a lifetime guarantee, as a matter of fact. Different types of feeders for different types of food. And of course, you know, there are actually different food blends you use in the summer than you use in the winter months. Wild Birds Unlimited knows all about that. I'll promise you the grocery store doesn't. Wild Birds Unlimited gets the freshest and best seeds. They have seeds that will exclude the birds you don't want, like the white-winged doves and the pigeons, and yet attract the beautiful songbirds you're looking for. But let's go beyond birds. Wild Birds Unlimited has a tremendous selection of gifts, things that are going to be absolutely wonderful for Father's Day here in a short while. And they're just nice people to deal with. They're open 7 days a week to serve you. They have the very best in information for you, so much experience. You just need to visit our Wild Birds Unlimited right out there on Northwest Military Highway. They're at the shopping center at the corner of Northwest Military and Huebner. That would be on the southwest corner, right there on the side that faces Northwest Military Drive. You need to just get out and visit them. They're open 7 days a week to serve you, and if you ever have a question, you always give them a call at 479-BIRD. That's 210-479-BIRD for Wild Birds Unlimited.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
Very good. All right, back to gardening here on a nice, sort of typical late spring, early summer Sunday morning. And going to be a great day to get out and get things done. Remember, doing things organically. If you want to fertilize, doesn't matter whether your grass is wet or dry. Doesn't have to be watered in as long as you're staying organic. Just don't let the weather get in the way of all those things you plan to do outside today. Looks like we're going to be spend more time dry than we do wet, but can't rule out that little bit of a shower. Let's see. Shirley, Martin, Doran, those are my next three callers, and Shelley is up first. Good morning, Shelley. Shirley, good morning, Shirley.
Hi, Shirley. I mean,
can't read bone writing here.
I want to say, yes, it's me.
Very good.
Anyway, I have a question for you. Do you still have a lot of vegetables down there, Bob?
We do have a number of vegetables. Now, I'll tell you, in all honesty, there's some things that it's not really time to plant. Among those things would be things like large fruited tomatoes. We will plant a fall crop beginning in July, but right now the night temperatures are getting warm enough that your big fruited types are not really going to be setting much fruit. So cherry tomatoes only at this time. Peppers are still a good time to plant. Eggplant is still time to plant, although it is in limited supply. Certainly still time to plant okra, cucumber, squash. Now, some of those things I recommend from plants, others I recommend from seed. So, long answer to a short question, yes, there are lots of things to plant. Yes, we have a lot of them. I'm sure most of the nurseries do, but certainly not the variety that we have in March and April.
And you're open on Monday?
We're open every day. Our hours are 9 to 4 Monday through Saturday and 10 to 4 on Sundays. So just come wander through. It's a pretty place. People compare us to the Botanical Garden frequently, and getting prettier all the time. This spring has been a challenge finding plant material, but and there's some things, big trees and all, they're still hard to come by. But if you, I think most of the nurseries around are really starting to look pretty good again. So just a good place to get out and visit.
Okay, one other question for you. I know you have a veterinarian friend.
Yes.
I don't have fleas in my yard, so to speak, but we do have a dog, and she gets out in other areas, and of course we have deer in the front yard. But I'm wondering what you do for flea control on your animals, dogs.
Well, you know, that's a really good question, and that's a question you probably should address with your veterinarian, because here are the concerns. There are products that combine flea protection and heartworm protection. I don't use them, and my vet, Dr. Kirby, doesn't recommend them, because sometimes the flea protection will give the dog an upset tummy, and then you don't know whether the dog's gotten his heartworm protection or not. So I give HeartGuard heartworm protection, and then on a different day I will deal with the flea protection. Now, if your dog does not have any nerve issues, if your dog has never had seizures or anything like that, there are medications, oral medications that your dog can take. The two most popular ones, one of them is called NexGard, the other is called Comfortis, and those are oral pills that your dog can take that will control fleas. But if your dog has any history of seizures or issues like that, they should not take those products, in which case I use a spray, and one of my dogs can take NexGard, the other one can't. The one that can't take NexGard, I use a spray called Wonderside. I buy it from a pet shop up in Burney, but I know it's available a lot of places, and it's just so totally safe. Flea products can be very toxic, and there are animals that are killed by improper use of flea products, so it's a great question for you to ask. But it's certainly easiest if your veterinarian says that your dog is okay with an oral medication, either Comfortis or NexGard, but if not, if you're going to use a flea spray, I would stay strictly away from the toxic chemicals. The Wonderside works really well. It's based on a couple of herbal oils, and it's totally safe for dogs and cats and puppies and kittens. Long answer to a short question.
That sounds what I would like, Bob, because I'm not into anything that might harm one of the animals. So,
well, I'm with you. I like my pets more than I like a lot of people in the world. So it's our responsibility to take care of them, and they do expect free health care, but we won't go down that road.
You're talking about the large tomatoes. I have so many large tomatoes still on there. Stay green,
good.
I suppose, because we don't have enough sun.
Yeah, that's exactly right. As soon as we start getting some more sun, they'll start ripening. You'll probably have more tomatoes than you know what to do with, but you can always make lots of friends with good ripe tomatoes. So, they just need some sun. The sun will very definitely improve the flavor as well as the color, and we're going to get there. Don't know exactly when, but looking at the calendar tells me that long sunny days are not too far away.
I have a squirrel that comes in my garden and eats the ripe tomatoes. You have a something. Will it keep the squirrels away? A spray?
No. I mean, there are some things out there you can try. There's a company called I Must Garden that makes some of the most, environmentally friendly sprays. But squirrels are a rodent. Squirrel is basically a big rat. I call them bushy-tailed tree rats. And if they're hungry for a ripe tomato, the sprays may slow them down, but it certainly won't stop them. I basically keep a live trap out, and the squirrels go to live somewhere down the road. And occasionally some of them are no longer among the living. But I do believe in trap and relocate. There's netting that you can throw over the cages. It will certainly keep the birds away, and it will slow the squirrels down. But, they're kind of like you and I are. You can go to an awful great lengths to get a good, juicy, ripe tomato, and the blasted squirrel feel the same way. So the bird netting will slow them down, but only secure way to not have them is to eliminate them or relocate them.
Yeah, right. I'm kind of for the elimination, but anyway, Bob, I do thank you for your time.
You sound like a neighbor of mine that used to live up the road from me, and he was asking me, we fight black mantle rock squirrels up there, and he was asking me what I use for bait in the trap, and I told him, and saw him a week later and said, has it gotten him into the trap? And he says, no, but it slows him down to where I can at least get a good shot at him. So you deal with it the best you can, and you have a wonderful Sunday, Shirley.
Thank you. You too, Bob.
Thank you. Goodbye. All right. Next up is Martin. Good morning, Martin.
Yes, sir. It's Mark. Well, anyway.
Hi, Mark. Okay.
I've had a question about my orange trees. They're pretty much gone, and I'm thinking ahead now. Would it be okay to plant a new orange tree in the dead orange tree's place, or whatever?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The only thing that hurt these orange trees was freezing weather. It wasn't disease. It wasn't greening. It wasn't all the problems you hear about. It just got too blasted cold for citrus. And is your tree coming out at all, or is it just dead from top to bottom?
It's pretty much dead. I had about 8 orange trees, and they're all dead, and some of them have the little sprouts coming up from underneath, but I think that's the graft, so it's not going to work out.
Well, what you can do, those sprouts are coming off the rootstock, and if you choose to, you could actually let them grow up a bit and then regraft them, put a good orange variety back onto that rootstock since it's still there and growing, or you can just plant new trees. Now, the problem with new trees is that they are real hard to find right now because you are among several million people in Texas that lost citrus, and consequently, the citrus growers are just overwhelmed. The state of Texas will not allow citrus to be imported. We can't buy it out of Louisiana or California or Florida or these places that grow a lot of citrus. All the citrus sold in Texas has to be certified and grown in Texas, and the growers simply can't keep up. So citrus is real hard to come by. So it may be fall, it might even be next spring before you find new good varieties of oranges to replant. So that makes thinking about regrafting what's there sometimes a little bit more realistic, but I tell you that just for information. You do whatever works best in Mark's life, but you're gonna find citrus trees to be in short supply. We actually got some lemons the other day from a grower that just turned out they had more than they needed, but I haven't seen oranges for probably 5 months now, and the grower that we use is telling us it's probably going to be August or September before they have anything ready. So don't be surprised if you have difficulty finding them, and remember that you cannot legally import them from anywhere outside of Texas. So just one more consideration for those of us that are replanting citrus.
It was, and hindsight being 2020, was there anything I could have done to save any of those orange trees? I mean, we had, we covered them, we had some Christmas lights on them, and I just don't know, was there anything that could have been done to keep them from dying?
Well, I had one friend that actually built a greenhouse, you know, over things, and that worked fine until CPS cut the power off, and then things froze. Where I live, I deal with a little bit more reliable energy provider, and they cut my power about 10 times a day, but it was only off for 20 minutes at a time. So my greenhouse, my things that I needed to keep warm, stayed warm. I'll tell you what we did here at the nursery, and we don't have citrus planted here, but we have a cold tender tree called the Hong Kong orchid tree. There was no way that I could even think about protecting the whole tree, so I wrapped it several layers thick with, you know, a Foss fabric, what we call insulate, and I wrapped the trunk of it about 4 feet up, and consequently the top of the tree froze. But the bottom of the tree came out to the point that it's already regrown. It's probably 6 feet tall, making multiple trunks there. So assuming that these trees are too big to really cover the whole thing, and 6 degrees is which is what a lot of us experience, and up in the Hill Country we had it even colder, it's just hard to cover things adequately. But if you were to replay this whole thing, if you would wrap the trunk of the trees multiple layers thick with burlap or insulate fabric or something like that, then you probably lose the top of the tree, but you'd still have enough of the good portion of the orange tree. And as I always say, you know, a citrus bush produces a lot more than a citrus tree. So I think going forward, that is certainly what I will recommend if we should face weather like this again. And, you know, it hasn't been this cold in 30 years. Hopefully it won't be this cold again for another 30 years, but it could also happen next winter. I think, yeah, that kind of tells you that global warming cannot be relied upon to keep us from getting too cold. So, but that's what we've done, and that's what pulled our super tender tree through. I actually had a caller yesterday that had pretty much done the same thing. I believe it was on an avocado rather than citrus, but same principle. You know, protect the trunk a few feet up, and then it will regrow even if you lose the top.
Do you think hay, like hay or straw, you know, at the base would have helped also, or?
If you could, you know, what the thing that protects from cold is insulation. I love my down vest. I love my down sleeping bag. And it's not that down retains heat, but down traps air, and that trapped air retains heat. So straw or shredded leaves or anything piled up, you know, around the trunk, that provides keeping that air in there, where it makes for wonderful insulation. And yes, if you could have piled it, you know, 4 or 5 feet high around the trunk, that certainly would have helped. But then you throw in the wind factor, and it gets hard to maintain. When we go to the gift market in Atlanta, we frequently go over to their botanical garden over there, and Atlanta gets typically substantially colder than San Antonio does. And what they do with a lot of their more tender perennials, they'll make a cage, like a tomato cage, set it down over the top of the plant, and then just fill it up with dry leaves. And that creates enough of an insulative layer that even when that temperature gets kind of temperatures that we saw this winter, they have almost every winter, everything seems to come out very well. So yes, loose hay will help, but remember, it's not anything about the hay, it's just being able to trap the air and hold the air around the plant, around the trunk, around whatever you're trying to protect. That's kind of wrapping it up in its down jacket, and it will help a great deal. But again, wind can come into play, and in this case we got a lot of snow, and the snow was great. Snow actually protected a lot of things underneath it, but if that crushes down or pushes away the hay, then you lose the insulating quality of it.
Okay,
that makes sense.
That's a great idea. That's a great idea to think about this fall. I'll have some tomato cages, and I'll just start saving those leaves and maybe just piling things up just to be safe, because you never know what this weather's going to do.
Oh, yeah, and you may have to, you know, wrap a piece of bird netting or a piece of insulate or something around them to hold the leaves in place, but it certainly is a cheap and easy way, and like you say, you've already got the structure. Now, I always use some of my tomato cages to grow snow peas in the winter months, but if you're like me, you've you've got more tomato cages than you have wintertime needs, and works extremely well for that purpose.
Well, that's great. I appreciate the information, Bob. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure, Mark. Thanks for the call.
All right.
Goodbye.
All right.
need to get a break in here. And once again, what a pleasure it is for me to be able to talk to you about Dr. Mark Williamson. And again, you know, there are many things changing in life right now. Medicine is changing. Dentistry is changing. And had a long talk with the best doctor I know, and he was talking about how many people are getting into this sort of corporate dentistry and corporate medicine, where the big emphasis is on how many people you can see and how little time can you spend with them. Well, let me tell you, Dr. Williamson is just the absolute antithesis of that. He does not do that in any way. He prides himself on taking the time he needs to spend with his patients. And, I mean, this guy will be your friend as well as your dentist. And he is so broadly trained. Again, attend in modern medicine is send everything out to a specialist, not Dr. Williamson. He knows that specialists sometimes import the things they use when it comes to dentures and implants and things like that. He believes in good quality things from right here in this country and taking care of things himself. He is very, very broadly trained. There are very few dental issues that Dr. Williamson cannot take care of right there in his office, and that's going to save you time and money. Plus, it's just, you know, going to the dentist doesn't have to be a dreaded experience. It can actually be a pleasurable experience, and knowing that you're getting the dental care you need, the very best, well, that's for great peace of mind. If you do have a lot of anxiety, he learned from Dr. Staffel all the sedation dentistry techniques. So if you're looking for a good dentist, somebody that'll be your friend as well as an outstanding dentist, you really need to check out the office of Dr. Mark Williamson and Associates, 341-2569. That's how you get through to him. 210-341-2569 for Dr. Williamson and Associates.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster, News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, my next three callers are Doran, Joe, and Tim. And good morning, Doran.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I have a couple questions for you.
Okay.
Okay, the first one. I'm in Nixon. I've got black dirt. Mm-hmm. And I want to grow horseradish.
The issue is not going to be as much dirt as it's going to be temperature. Horseradish typically is grown in cooler climates. I love horseradish. I'm a big fan of sushi, and so consequently I really enjoy horseradish and ginger and things like that. And your soil's not going to be the issue. You can make a perfectly good soil just adding compost to your, you know, to your basic black loamy soil. But it's going to be tough to get through a hot summer anywhere in Texas with horseradish. Now, I tell you that I've not tried growing it, but having talked to a number of people, that's what I am told, is that it's not the soil, it's the heat. But I don't think you will find it. I don't think you'll find the plants for sale in your area or anywhere around here. If you want to go on the internet or something and give some a try, I would certainly pick a place with maybe morning sun, afternoon shade. If you had a big greenhouse with what we call a wet wall as part of your cooling system, you might try growing it sitting right in front of the wet wall. That's what some orchid growers I know that want to grow some cool growing orchid varieties do. But soil's not the issue. It's just going to be our summertime heat, I think you're going to find, is the biggest issue with horseradish. Now, maybe somebody will call and tell me they grow up very well here, and if so, we'll pick their brain about exactly how they do that. But if it were easily grown, there'd be a lot more of us have it in our gardens.
And is that also then same for elderberries?
Elderberry, it is a little bit more of a soil issue as well. Over where I am with the calcareous caliche soils, that has something to do with it. You may be successful growing elderberry. The people that I know, their biggest issue is probably fighting birds and things like that. But right. With your good deep black soil in Nixon, you may be able to grow elderberry. It's just not real commonly grown.
Okay, we just had a house built out here, and so I've got about a quarter of an acre. I want to, around the house, put grass.
Uh-huh.
What would be, you know, obviously it's just dirt right now, mud in our case, because it dropped 5 inches the other day, and before them.
Right. Well, my old friend Alton Grin, and mentor and friend, and we actually grew several acres of sod, told me there's no such thing as a perfect grass. They all have good points and bad points. The toughest, easiest, most resilient grass out there has got to be Bermuda grass. It also has the shortest green season. You will have chiggers in it. It's the first grass to turn brown in the fall.
Yeah.
Yep, and now you can control them, spraying with cedar oil and things like that. But beauty of Bermuda is that it loves the blasting hot sun. If it gets too dry, it'll just turn brown, and then it'll green up again when we get water. A much more pleasant grass is St. Augustine, which does not get chiggers, and there are varieties that do well in the bright sun, like Floritam. There are varieties that do very well in the shade, like Palmetto and Del Mar. The big issue with Floritam, or with St. Augustine, is, well, one big issue is that while Bermuda can be planted from seed, which makes it much cheaper, St. Augustine has to be planted from existing pieces of sod. Also, with St. Augustine, if it gets, you know, totally dried out, it dies. It doesn't turn brown and come back green. It turns brown and stays brown. So it's one that you have to water. Now, it doesn't take any more water to keep St. Augustine looking nice than it does to keep Bermuda looking nice, but if you stop watering, then you have real severe problems. The third grass that is often used is Zoysia. There are several kinds of Zoysia. The finer bladed Zoysias like El Toro and Emerald, those varieties have very, very few problems. The broader bladed varieties like Jammer tend to be more susceptible to brown patch. But the issue with Zoysia grasses, and they have to have the sun. They will not grow in the shade, just like Bermuda. But as my friend Howard Garrett describes them, as grasses that are beautiful to look at but not to live on. Zoysia is slow growing, so it doesn't require as much mowing, but it doesn't stand up to foot traffic as well. If you have kids or grandkids or big dogs that are going to run the yard regularly, you're going to have permanently worn paths in the grass. I grew up in a house with a permanently etched baseball diamond in the front yard where we had Zoysia grass. So it's not the perfect grass, but it is certainly a low maintenance grass, and it is a trouble-free grass. So those are there are some varieties like Zeon, which can be planted from seed, but the better Zoysias are planted from sod.
Is sod expensive?
Yes. it's like I say, Zoysia is slow growing, so it's definitely going to be more expensive than, say, St. Augustine. Bermuda, you have the choice, and it kind of depends on the variety you choose. The densest, toughest, most wear-resistant variety of Bermuda is what we call TIFF Bermuda, T-I-F-F. That's what they use on golf greens and things like that. TIFF Bermuda has to be planted from pieces of sod. Common Bermuda, and there's some improved varieties, can be planted from seed, but they are taller growing and, you know, just a totally different grass. So it's just you have to analyze your situation and, you know,
so
see what will...
Do I want chiggers or don't want chiggers?
And many people will compromise. They will plant something like St. Augustine close around the house where they can maintain it well and where they're going to be spending most of their time. And then they will do the outer portion of the yard either with something like common Bermuda or maybe even one of the native grasses, some of your bunch grasses and things that they don't really look like a manicured yard and you don't mow them exactly the same way. But it all comes down to, what you want out of your yard and how you plan to use your yard. So I can't lecture you and tell you you should do this and that. There are various people who will tell you you're crazy if you plant anything other than their kind of grass. But I always tell you, repeat what Alton taught me, and that there are, all grasses have both good qualities and bad qualities. So you simply need to choose the one that fits best in your area and your lifestyle.
Okay. Sounds like a plan. Thank you very much.
You're certainly welcome. Thank you for the call. You do the same. All right, got to get my last break of the hour in here, and then we'll be back to more phone calls. I get to talk about Fanix Nursery and Garden Center, and Fanix is one of those places that just been around, seems like forever, over 80 years. Fanix Nursery has been there offering quality plants and quality advice, and people that run Fanix, the Fanix family, They are true plants, man. I tell you, Mark and Mike, I know them well. Knew their mom, knew their dad, knew their granddad. But they are people who truly love plants. It's a business to them, but it is also a passion. And that's the kind of people that I love doing business with. Fanix is known for many things. Roses for one, fruit trees for another, and crepe myrtles at this time of year. Now, crepe myrtles are harder to come by. Fanix doesn't have their usual 70 to 100 varieties, but they've got a lot of varieties, and the selection is improving every week over there. So you just might want to get by and take a look. Everything from the little miniatures that grow 2 feet tall, the Basham's Party Pink that grows 35 feet tall. Fanix also has a wide range of organic materials for your yard in the form of composts and mulches and fertilizers. They even have some things that are go a little bit beyond the norm for a nursery. They have things like the Traeger pellet grills and all the accessories. They have the Ego lithium-ion battery-powered outdoor equipment. You got to check that stuff out to believe it. It's always a fun day to visit Fanix. They're open 7 days a week over on Home Green Road, right where they've been for over 80 years. Check them out online at Fanix, F-A-N-I-C-K, FanixNursery.com.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, back to gardening, back to the phone lines. My next three callers are Joe, Tim, and Susan, and Joe is up first. Good morning, Joe.
Yes, a couple weeks ago, Howard mentioned something about Bermuda loves that fertilizer, but St. Augustine, not so much. I vaguely remember hearing something that before, and could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, it's, you know, again, the type of fertilizer is very important, and you certainly want to stay with an organic fertilizer because the plants use 100% of it, and it builds the soil rather than deplete it the way the synthetic fertilizers do. But fertilizer usage is really directly proportional to the amount of sun a plant gets and its average growth rate. So Bermuda is a much higher sun grass, and it is a faster growing grass, especially the bigger varieties like Coastal that's being, you know, grown, baled, and basically removed for the property. So Bermuda is going to stay in its maximum state of health with a little bit more fertilizer than St. Augustine needs. Again, for a person who mows and bags and hauls off their clippings, fertilizing becomes increasingly important because you're throwing away a lot of good natural material. If you have a mulching mower, you leave the clippings in place, then that reduces your need for fertilizer. But in general, just because of the nature of the grass, of its growth rate, and the amount of sun it really does well in, Bermuda definitely likes a little bit more frequent fertilizing than St. Augustine needs.
Okay, well, I use both varieties, and now I know that if I put the fertilizer on my palmetto in the shade, that's not going to help it that much.
Well, nothing replaces the sun's energy. Palmetto very definitely will do best where it gets fertilized with some regularity, but it's not the thing that causes. If you have problems with palmetto, it's usually lack of light rather than lack of fertilizer. So you're exactly right. It should be fed periodically, but certainly doesn't help to overfeed it.
Okay, and the last point is, you said after the hot summer comes, when it comes, wait till the middle of September or early October to do another fertilizing treatment.
Makes no difference whatsoever when you're using organic. When you're using the synthetic fertilizers, tend to greatly increase water use. They really increase the uptake of water because it's a hot, dry period. We can get what is commonly referred to as a burn. In truth, it is dehydration damage that happens in the hot summer. When you're going with an organic product like Medina or MaestroGrow, Nature's Creation, one of those good fertilizers, you can use them 365 days a year with no fear of damaging your grass, and it's kind of contradictory to say don't feed in the summer, because in the summer that's when your grasses are growing the most and when they're probably using the most nutrition. So I very definitely would do some summertime fertilizing, but I also would stay 100% on the fertilizer, organic on the fertilizer that I use. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir. I use that Growing Green. That's all I use as what I learned from you.
You use that in July and August, and don't worry about it one bit.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Bye. My pleasure, Joe. Thank you, sir. And goodbye. All right. Let's hope Tim has a little better phone connection there. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
Zero escape garden going on, and I wanted to put some flowering plants in there, low flowering plants.
Okay.
And I had a list. One I really like, it's called Woolly Speedwell. Veronica pictinata.
It will grow. It doesn't have a long blooming period, but you can certainly grow Veronica here. I'm not going to necessarily tell you that it's, you know, it's the most outstanding one for drought conditions, but it will grow. But it's certainly not going to give you the number of flowers of Portulaca or Purslane or some of our others that are, you know, lower water use plants. But that one can be grown here. What's next on the list?
I have rock rose.
Rock rose or pavonia. It's a good plant. There's a pink form, and then there's one they call a Brazilian rock rose. It is sort of a beige color. They're going to make a moderate height. Most winters, it freezes down virtually every year. Most winters, it comes back, but a very good plant for this area.
Okay, and germander.
Creeping germander is a fair plant. It's not as drought tolerant as some things, but in a good sunny area, you can certainly grow germander. Not real showy in flowers, but it's a pretty plant. Nothing wrong with it at all.
Okay, and then I have Penstemon husker.
Penstemons are a big family of plants, and they have a very brief period that they are really pretty. You can grow it, but it's not something that I'm going to recommend. There are other things that give you a lot more color for a lot less work.
Okay, and I was wondering if you had any other recommendations.
Oh, absolutely. If you want some other pretty flowers, look at Blackfoot Daisy. It's a type of Melampodium that's very good for xeriscape. The pink form and the white form of Skullcap or Scutellaria are extremely colorful plants that fit into a xeriscape extremely well. There's a little Texas native plant called Zexmania, beautiful yellow flowers. There's another Texas native called Damianita. And that's its easier name, Chrysectinia, is its botanical name. Very aromatic foliage, beautiful yellow flowers. It grows in the Jeep roads all over my ranch, and absolutely beautiful and very, very low maintenance. If you want to look at herbs, other herbs that will fit in, thyme will fit in very well. Rosemary will fit in very well. There's a little plant called Santolina, Santolina. There is a gray form and a green form, mainly grown for their foliage, but they do have some pretty yellow flowers as well. So I could go on and on, but those were a few more to consider. We actually have a list if you want to stop by and pick them up. And I'll have to hold you there because it's news time.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right, back to gardening and what is a very nice Sunday morning out there. And got so much to do, so many beautiful things to do in the landscape, and I hope you're planning on getting out there today. Next three callers, Susan, Tim, and Jill. Susan is up first. Good morning, Susan.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I have questions about hydrangeas.
Okay.
Which I know they're not native and take a ton of water. I bought some at your nursery in the early spring. And have them planted in pots on my porch and above my pool, above the waterfall.
Mm-hmm.
Looked great. They still look great, except the pink flowers and the blue flowers are now all green.
Uh-huh.
So I'm thinking that something acid or basic is going to influence that.
Well, it is to some extent. Now, you know, we have to broaden the topic a little bit when we talk about hydrangeas, because there are two general types, what I would call a really showy hydrangeas, which are the ones that you see in San Francisco and East Texas and, you know, through the deep south. And then we do have a hydrangea which is actually very well adapted to our soil. oils and all. And it's called an oak leaf hydrangea. It's one of a group they call lace cap, and they don't have that giant showy head of flowers, but they're a lot tougher, and they are not nearly as water demanding. The more showy varieties, which is what you have planted, they're always going to be beautiful in the spring, and they're always going to be less attractive in the summer, and they're always going to demand a ton of water year-round. Don't have to worry about winters. They freeze back partially, but they always come back out. There's no way that you're really going to keep a blue hydrangea blue in San Antonio unless you're growing it in a greenhouse in a totally artificial soil mix and just babying it along. But now the pinks, you can maintain a bit of color. The greening is a little bit normal as we get into summer because it's sort of in the plant's own way of thinking, which is not conscious thought, but it says, I'm past my real pretty blooming season, so I might as well, dedicate this space to something I fill up with chlorophyll so that it's going to, continue to absorb the sun's energy and support the plant. But the really pretty colorful flowering hydrangeas, they're mainly like Indian hawthorns and other things that just bloom in the spring, and there really is not a lot you can do to get them real showy through the summer months. Now, there are a couple of new varieties out there. I've not seen them available yet this year, so I doubt very much that they're the ones you got. But there's a new series called Endless Summer. And so far, they come basically pink and white. And those are going to be a little bit better at giving you some additional flowers through the summer months. But they're water demanding. Hydrangeas are certainly one of the most water demanding plants that you will ever plant. But in summer, you're just not really going to have a lot of colorful flowers on them. That's like wishing your azaleas bloomed in the summer. And there's some of them that do, the Encore series, but many of our plants, they're beautiful in the spring, and then they're just green shrubs the rest of the year. And unfortunately, most of the hydrangeas kind of fall into that category.
Okay, because I know these are not oak leaf, but mm-hmm. If I understood you correctly, can I plant oak leaf hydrangeas in the ground in my yard?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. They are a wonderful shrubby plant. Now, again, they do not have the showy flowers. They have a typical hydrangea flower, but it's not the brilliant colored, and it doesn't have 50 little flowers open at one time. It blooms with a few flowers along. If you look up what they call lace cap hydrangeas, you'll see some other varieties, but it's either just called oak leaf or it's frequently called Alice oak leaf. Is a wonderful shrub for the shade here, and a very interesting plant, but it's not that thing that's going to cause people to leave tire marks on your curb. As our former county agent used to say, you can measure the success of your plantings by the number of tire marks on the curb where people ran off the road trying to see what you had planted over there. and the oak leaf hydrangea is never going to be quite that spectacular, but it is a good, hardy, actually a reasonably good xeriscape plant.
Okay, well, great. Well, thank you very much.
And the money that you're going to try to spend to have those beautiful things, buy a plane ticket to San Francisco and see what they can really look like driving along some of those streets down toward the bay. They're absolutely wonderful, and they can be spectacular here. But unfortunately, it's pretty much going to be a spring-only plant. So anyway, it's good to talk to you this morning. Hope you have a good Sunday.
Yep, you too.
Thank you so much. Goodbye. All right, Tim is up next. Good morning, Tim. Oh, he dropped off. Well, that would make Jill next in line. Good morning, Jill.
Hi, got a couple of questions, if that's okay.
That's what I'm here for.
You have a lady on Earth Day. She was talking about genetically altered bacteria, and I kind of missed some of that, and I lost the website. I lost it. I can't find it. Do you have a name or something where I can, or could you just tell us more about what you had to say?
Well, I don't know of any intentionally genetically modified bacteria out there. There are cells, there are plant varieties which have been genetically altered to encourage their cells to produce toxins, which, you know, some bacteria frequently produce. And this is mainly the BT toxin, which they now have introduced into varieties of corn, which I avoid 100%. But Dr. Dick Richardson, many years ago, Professor Emeritus of Genetics over at the University of Texas, in the first lecture I actually heard on genetic modification, his comment was, when we put these genetic modifications into the DNA of field crops, that that material winds up in the genome, so to speak, of bacteria in the soil. In a lot of cases, we don't know exactly what it does, but one of the things that is happening with crops that are genetically modified to resist the Roundup herbicide, that gene has made its way into soil bacteria, which have reintroduced that gene into other plants, and now we have other weeds that used to be killed by Roundup that are resistant to it instead. And the thought is that the way that that genetic material has migrated from one plant to another is through bacteria in the soil. But I don't really, and I don't recall a caller that was talking about intentionally modified DNA and bacteria. So the bacteria are, you know, basically a primitive life form, but they can pick up genetic material because some of them actually move in and out through openings in plant roots and things like that. And I, you know, again, microbiology has changed so much since the many years that I got my degrees in biology. So I'm not aware of any bacteria that has been intentionally modified, but I know that there are a lot of bacteria that pick up genetic modifications that have been artificially introduced into plants and probably into animals as well.
Sir, she wasn't talking about intention. I don't believe she's talking about intentionally, but I think you might have answered my question. Mm-hmm. But I missed so much of what you were saying. It sounded like it was a guest you had on Earth Day or right around
no.
Earth Day.
No, my only guest is Howard Garrett. Howard Garrett's the only guest that I have on. And might not have even been me, but I would imagine that's what the topic was about. But there is no doubt that soil bacteria, in their infinite numbers, and there are thought to be somewhere over 20,000 different species of soil bacteria in a teaspoon of healthy soil, but because of their life cycle, but because of the way that they work in the environment and their close interrelationships with many plants, they wind up with some of the genetic material out of the plant. And in the case of some of these intentionally modified genomes that they are doing in everything from corn to cotton, we're winding up with soil bacteria that have totally unintended genetic material in them. And long term, we don't know what the consequences are. I personally don't think that they will be good. Dr. Richardson said that we've just opened a Pandora's box that we'll never be able to close. So future's still out there. You may find more information on that somewhere like Acres USA.
I got a question.
What's that now?
I got another question.
Okay.
You were talking about rainwater, when it comes down as rain, the hydrogen was closer together, the angle on the oxygen atom. Did I hear that right?
That's what, and I asked that question of Dr. Elaine Ingham because I had grown up, my training in the sciences, I understood that it was basically a fixed angle between the two hydrogen atoms that are attached to the oxygen atom to make water. But she was explaining that magnetic fields and various other things, such as the spin that raindrops apparently go through as they come down, can actually modify the angle of the two hydrogen atoms, and technically that turns water into a smaller molecule, which becomes more permeable as far as being able to go through membranes. Again, it's not well understood, and it's not a permanent thing. Given time, that angle opens back up. But when rainwater falls, and I'm sure you've heard, we don't hear as much as we used to about people putting magnets on their water lines and how it supposedly did wonderful things for detergents, and putting magnets on fuel lines in cars and it made them run more efficiently. There is evidence that a magnetic field can vary, not the chemical makeup of something, but can vary the way that these atoms are bound together. And yes, that's what we were talking about, that certain factors can influence the angle between the two hydrogens on the water molecule, and in effect make it go through membranes more easily. So anyway, that's a little bit of deep science, and at that point I need to move on and do a commercial here, and we'll come back to other things. Need to get back to phone calls in a moment, but first of all, I get to talk to you about the Tank Depot. Speaking of water, what a great segue into talking about rainwater and all the many, many, many benefits that it provides. And you just didn't have to have good tanks to collect it. And boy, if you don't have rainwater tanks, you have sure missed out on the opportunity to get a lot of free water over the past few weeks. But, you know, even in our driest years, it's amazing how much rainwater you can collect off the average home roof. Now, you may want to go ahead and, you know, treat it with a UV filter or something like that to where it becomes the best drinking water you will ever see. Or you may just plan to use it in your landscape. But whatever uses you have for it, you got to have the tanks. And the place you're going to find the widest selection of quality tanks at the best prices, you got it. It's the Tank Depot. Same thing's true for chemical storage tanks or transfer tanks for the back of the pickup, or open top tanks or bait tanks, or maybe a big tank to make you compost tea. You're going to find all those things over at the Tank Depot. Wonderful selection, best prices around, delivery available, especially on the bigger tanks. It's the Tank Depot here in San Antonio, located over on Southeast Loop 410, just south of Rigsby Avenue. Not open today. I don't think they're really open on the weekends very much, but weekdays you can certainly go see them over there. Today you can certainly go to their website, which is tank-depot.com.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, back to gardening on a nice Sunday morning. Getting brighter out there, but I'm not anxious for the sun to come out. It's very definitely going to be a little steamy when that happens, but it is bright, it is dry. It is going to be a great day to get some things done out in the garden, and like I was saying earlier, do not fall to that old thing they tell you about chemical synthetic fertilizers, that you can't use them when the soil and grass are wet. Not true of the organics. If it's time to put out fertilizer, this is a great day to put out fertilizer, and organics do not have to be watered in. So add that to your list of things that you might need to do if you haven't done that in the past 3 or 4 months. Looks like our next three callers are Karen and Dave and Debbie. Karen's up first. Good morning, Karen.
I have planted a pot of geraniums.
Okay.
Earlier in the year, and I'm wondering, what can I expect now that it's going to be hot? Are they going to go away?
They're not going to go away, but they're going to struggle. Geraniums in San Antonio and South Texas are beautiful in the spring, beautiful in the fall, and they kind of limp through the summer months. And doesn't matter whether you're talking the scented geraniums or the big zonal geraniums, they will still grow if you fertilize them. I do recommend that you keep them in a shadier area during the summer. Morning sun's fine, but afternoon sun is just awful hard on them. But they're between spectacular periods. They're going to be spectacular spring and fall, and they're going to struggle along this time of the year no matter what you do. Be careful that you don't keep them constantly wet. They want to get good and dry on the surface between waterings. They would love a little has to grow or something like that every 2 or 3 weeks, but it's going to be October before you're going to fall in love with them again.
Okay. So, but they won't totally die. Well, are they worth keeping, or will they not look good in October?
And that all depends on how patient a person you are. And I laugh because I deal with this on a daily basis. And, you know, the cold this winter, I can't tell you how many people I had come in say, oh, my foxtails all died, and I want to get new ones. And I say, no, they didn't die. They're going to come out fine. Cut those frozen tops. And they say, well, I'm not that patient. I want new ones anyway. So it kind of comes down to, if you're a patient person, they are certainly worth carrying through the summer. If you would rather have lots of color, throw them out and plant periwinkles instead, or plant angelonia, or there are a lot of things that will be beautiful, tropical plants like bougainvilleas and hibiscus and mandevillas and things like that. So it's totally up to you, and I'm kind of teasing you, Karen, but everybody's different. Some people love to save their geraniums for the summer, and some people can't wait to get rid of them and put some like periwinkles out there for the hot months.
Well, they're in a pot, so I can move it to a different
place. Sure. But get yourself another pot now. Get yourself another pot and plant some periwinkles, because they are gorgeous right now. But I'm sorry, go ahead.
I have received a potted outside plant, mm-hmm. And it's got coleus and I think salvias in there and some other things.
Okay.
I've never had salvia before, and I'm not sure that's what it is. But the leaves look droopy all the time. Is that just the way they look, or do they need more water?
Well, first of all, there were well over 100 kinds of salvia commonly grown, so it's hard to paint with too broad a brush. The things that will make plants droop, and salvias are certainly among this group, they will certainly droop if they get too dry, but they will also droop if it's real windy. They will also droop if they're getting more sun. And the mechanism here is, in all cases, it's just the plant's losing water faster than it can take it up. My general rule on most plants drooping is if they're drooping in the afternoon, don't worry about it. That may just be the weather. If they're still drooping the next morning, they need to be, need a good thorough drink. But it just would depend on what kind of salvia it is. Just remember, when you water, to water super, super thoroughly, but then don't water again till the soil's dry about a knuckle deep. Now, unfortunately, with these people that do these combination planters, sometimes mix sun-loving plants with shade-loving plants, and they're just not good combinations. What makes your coleus happy may not make your salvia happy. And at some point, you may want to put them in their own individual containers. Somebody that really knows what they're doing can blend things together. But if your salvia remains droopy, it may just be that it could be that you're not watering thoroughly enough, but it may just be that it's getting more sun than what it really likes. But if you've got other things that need more sun in that pot, it's going to be hard to make everybody happy at the same time.
Well, do salvia leaves kind of hang more so than perfectly outright? I mean, do they kind
it
of
is it totally depends on the variety. Most of the annual salvias will be more upright. Some of the perennial salvias, like the black and blue sage, the eyelash sage, some of those will very definitely have a little bit droopier habit, whereas some of the others, like your salvia greggii, your salvia leucantha, have a much smaller leaf that is very permanently much more upright. So kind of depends on the variety. I would suggest, if you can, either take a good close-up picture of what you have and let a good plant person take a look at it with you, or if it's not too big a deal, take the plant in and let somebody that knows take a look and tell you what's going on. But it may just be that whoever put that combination together did not really know what they were doing and planted a shade lover with a sun lover, or one that likes it dry with one that likes it wet. I see this problem with florist combinations all the time.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Bob.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you for the call. All right. Let's see here. Let's go ahead and take another phone call. That would be Dave. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Listen, I have a couple questions, but one is, I think, one of your favorite topics. That we have an orchid. Somebody gave us about 2 years ago, and it didn't do anything for a long time.
Okay.
Now, all of a sudden, it's produced two stems of the most beautiful variegated purple flowers.
Okay.
And so I'm just sitting here looking at it. Anyway, my question is, when these are finally spent, do you cut the stem off down at the bottom, or just bob it, or what do you do with that stem?
Do you have any idea what kind of orchid this is? Does it have
it to you? But no, I have not a clue.
Does it have big flat leaves? My business partner used to call them cow tongues. Big flat leaves that come out to the side?
Yes.
Okay, then that's the most common kind right now. Realize there are over 25,000 different species and like 300,000 hybrids out there now, and they grow on every continent except the Antarctic, so it's sometimes hard to generalize. But what you're describing sounds like the Phalaenopsis orchid. And as the blooms fade, sometimes they will start growing at the tip of the bloom spike and put on another set of flowers up there. Sometimes they will branch out from further down that bloom spike below where the original flowers were. They'll put on a little side branch that has more flowers on it. So my rule on that type is, as long as that flower spike is green, leave it alone, because it might just decide to produce more blooms for you. But once it starts to turn brown and crispy, that's the time you want to go ahead and cut it off. And the plant, with good care, with time, will produce all new spikes coming out from down between those big old leaves. But for now, keep it out of the draft from a ceiling fan. They do not like to have moving air. That will very definitely shorten the life of the flowers. Typically, if you have them in a bright place, and this plant must be reasonably happy or it wouldn't be back in bloom, but if you've got it where it gets good light, if you're watching your watering, those new flowers can easily last 6 weeks each. Bloom spike can stay in bloom for, you know, 3 or 4 months at a time. But when the spike gives up and finally gets brown and crisp, that's the time you'll trim it off altogether.
Okay, but if it does turn brown, trim it off all the way down to where it comes out of the leaves?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the whole thing. Okay.
Yeah, the whole thing, because the plant in time will move a couple of layers up, so to speak, and between the leaves up above that, it'll put on a new spike and the bloom start all over. If you're lucky, it'll put out one on each side of the plant. I had one last year put out 5 bloom spikes at one time and had like 50 flowers open at once. So they can be quite spectacular, and how many it puts on, a lot depends on the breeding, but Phalaenopsis alone, there are probably 60,000-80,000 hybrids of it, so makes it a little hard to generalize, but obviously you're giving it good care or it wouldn't be blooming. But enjoy it while it's in bloom. When that spike ultimately turns brown and crispy, just cut it down as far as you can cut it down without damaging the leaves.
Okay, thank you. Pecan trees. I've got one. Well, with all this rain, that sucker has exploded.
Yes, sir.
I mean, but you mentioned in some shows in the past, I listen to you almost every week. But
I appreciate it.
You mentioned, I believe it was some sort of caterpillar that cuts off limbs and they fall and they look like actually they've been cut with something sharp.
Yep, it's called a twig girdler. It's actually a beetle, not a caterpillar, but the little stem will look like it's been run through an old fashioned pencil sharpener, and they're common. They're not really harmful to the tree. They don't do enough damage. If you would like to be rid of them, just gather up those little twigs that have dropped, because a twig, it's called a twig girdler. It lays its eggs on the bark outside toward the end of the limb, and then it cuts the limb off, the eggs hatch, the larvae develop in the soil, and the cycle starts all over. So if you're simply very vigilant about picking up all those little limbs and disposing of them, burning them, throwing them out, doing something totally different with them, that sort of cuts off the next generation, and it'll be much less of a problem. But this is not a threat to the life of your tree or anything like that. It's strictly a nuisance.
Yeah, okay. That's what I wanted to remind you. I
didn't think it
was a serious problem, and I do find them laying on the ground. You know,
yeah, it's only a serious problem if your wife's on your back all the time telling you to get out there and pick them up because they're ugly. Now, that can be a serious problem, I'd say jokingly, but it doesn't threaten the life of the tree at all.
Okay. The other thing is that I mentioned earlier, this tree has virtually exploded. Now, my house faces north and south,
okay.
So I like a deciduous tree in the backyard, which is faces south, which would be this pecan tree.
But
it's so big, and it's putting out so much shade now. that mm-hmm. I'm having trouble having something grow underneath it. Now, I've lived, this is a lesson in aging. I've lived here for over 30 years.
Yes, sir.
I can't believe it changes. And I did some things about 15 years ago that have come back to haunt me.
Sure.
And, such as trying to grow Bermuda grass in an area where I couldn't quite get enough water out to it. Now,
sure.
I can't get rid of the stuff.
Well, it's pecan trees, and again, in a year where we get the rainfall that we've got in the past month or 6 weeks, they're going to put on a lot more leaves. Oak trees are the same way. Our trees are going to be a lot denser this summer simply because of the moisture. In a dry year, the trees put on fewer leaves because, of course, that's where the moisture goes. The tree takes us up through its roots and loses it out through the leaves. So it's good for a plant in a wet year to have lots of leaves. It's good for a plant in a dry year to have fewer leaves. So there are things that will tolerate the shade. Unfortunately, the things that really love the shade, like Aspidistra and holly fern, then sometimes they sunburn in the winter months when the leaves come off the tree. But there are things that you can grow underneath there. You'll just have to be a little bit more specific in what you grow, in ground covers and flowers and various other things. But there are things that will do. In moderate shade, sometimes if it's just deep, deep, deep shade, what you'll end up is taking plants that tolerate deep shade, like Aspidistra or cast iron plant, but put them in pots so that they'll be beautiful through the summer months out there. But then when the leaves fall off in the winter months, that you can drag them up where they're not in quite so much sun so they don't sunburn. But sadly, you can't have it both ways. And what was a moderate amount of shade this year may be dense shade somewhere down the road. I don't think it's practical or even a good idea to try to thin the trees out, although some people do that. But I think you just kind of have to change your gardening to accommodate for the fact that you've got a lot more shade than you used to have. And just be thankful you've got that beautiful pecan tree, because you're sure going to have lower energy bills when it does get hot this summer.
Yeah, okay. Well, thank you very much for your time. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, Dave. Thank you, sir. Goodbye. All right, need to get a break in here. Debbie will be up first when we come back, but I get to talk to you about the Cedar Eater of Texas, and let me tell you what, pecan trees aren't the only ones that have exploded into growth. That ash juniper out there, man, it's growing like mad, and I'll tell you what, if it's still there next winter when it starts producing all those berries, you're going to have quite a crop of seeds, and your cedar problem's only going to get worse. Why not get rid of the cedar now before it gets hot and dry in the summer and becomes a fire hazard? Get rid of it now before it grows up and chokes your land even more. Get rid of it now before it goes into that reproductive cycle next fall and starts producing so many seeds. So how do you get rid of it? You call the cedar eater. Now, if you got unlimited time and money and all, I guess you could cut it and rent a chipper and chip it up. But let me tell you, you don't want to burn and bulldoze, which is what a lot of people do. You want to get someone like the cedar eater that does it in an environmentally friendly fashion. They come in with a machine that cuts the cedar off at ground level. That kills it effectively and then grinds it into a nice mulch all in one operation. Dense areas, they'll have a crew clear it out by hand, drag the cedar out in the open, and then that same machine just almost instantly pulverizes it into a really, really good mulch. Cedar eater can do a few acres or a few thousand acres. The flatter the land is, the more acres they can do in a single day, but they work even in some pretty rough environments. It's just they've been doing it for so many years, and like I say, so many different agencies, from Parks and Wildlife to the Highway Department, land managers of all sorts, they use the cedar eater because they do the job, they do it right, they do it at a reasonable price. Why don't you learn more? Why don't you give them a call, 210-745-2743. And by the way, they have a North Texas and a South Texas office, both, and you get to both of them through the same phone number, 210-745-2743 for the Cedar Eater of Texas.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right. My next two callers are Debbie and Susan, and Debbie is up first. Good morning, Debbie.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I was at your home away from home yesterday. What an incredible
beautiful place you have.
Well, thank you so much. Don't give me all the credit, though. We have a wonderful staff here of immensely talented people, and we got some awful good growers around. As a matter of fact, there's supposed to be a big truck from California here in about an hour. So I'm glad you enjoy your visit. Hope you'll do it again.
Yes, so I certainly will. Donna helped me out a lot. It seems like moving out to the true country, there's a whole set of other things that you learn about. And so she helped me with some cutter ant sulfur mixture and then also the come and get it fire ants.
Right.
And, you know, we're going to work on that. And then what about red ants that are crawling up wires?
Well, the red ants are a very important part of the ecology of the hill country. That particular ant is food for horned lizards and other lizards, food for a number of birds and things like that. So unless they are causing damage, I ignore them. Now, the same bait that you talked about for fire ants, and by the way, those ants are called harvester ants, the same bait that gets the fire ants will get them. But I tend to leave them alone. I have enough acreage that they can have their areas, and I have my areas. But
good, then I'm fine with that, too. And
good.
Then even on you know, wasps and everything else, as long as they're not next to a door, they also, you know, are part of it as well.
Well, and they take care of a lot of different caterpillar issues. Now, I have to tell you, those solid red wasps can get so aggressive I tend to eliminate them. But your red and black wasp, yeah, your yellow jackets, things like that, we cohabitate very happily. But those red guys have stung me one time too many.
Yeah, and then I also understood from a home inspector that he would rather take a bite from a scorpion because they also take care of black widows and brown recluses. True or false?
No, false. The dirt daubers, mud daubers, whatever you call them by, which are a wasp, they are the ones that take care of the spiders. And they, you know, brown recluse, black widows, garden spiders, they actually sting and paralyze those guys. And then they drag them off to where they're building their little nest, and their eggs hatch into larvae, which feed on the paralyzed spiders. So the dirt daubers are the ones that control the undesirable spiders. The wasps are mainly caterpillar eaters.
And I noticed a few spider webs in the home have caught a scorpion. Do they just happen to walk in and get caught?
They, I had a scorpion in my bathroom the other day, but I live in a 115-year-old house, and they can go under doors and things like that. You'll get a lot of just nuisance little spiders and web makers and cobweb makers.
And I'm okay with those.
Yeah,
I'm okay with those. The scorpions, you know, no.
The scorpions, they eat things like cockroaches and such as that. Not that you have those in your house, but they're looking for.
I haven't seen any of those. Plenty
that's
of scorpions
good.
On occasion.
Yeah, the scorpions, a couple of different ways to take care of them in drier times. And scorpions are usually just a problem with new construction because, you'll have a lot of them when you first build a new home, but I probably have two or three a year inside my house. But if they're an issue when it's dry, you can simply put a band of diatomaceous earth, the white, powdery, inexpensive material. Not poison, but it's abrasive. Just put a band of that around the perimeter of your home, and that pretty much will stop the scorpions and some other things.
Okay.
If they are an issue inside, the glue traps that we occasionally use for rats and mice, they are great for catching scorpions. I try not to leave them out. My old home is a two-story home, and a few years ago, in the middle of the night, I heard this ka-thunk, ka-thunk, ka-thunk sound like a wooden-legged pirate coming up the stairs. And my little kitty cat had managed to...
when you're living alone, too.
The firearms are close at hand. But got up and looked, and one of my kitties had managed to step on one of the glue traps and was walking up the steps. So
I was thinking it was a large scorpion that was dragging it around.
Oh, no, thank goodness not. not that. But anyway, we did a little barbering with the scissors to get her foot loose. So be sure you're putting the glue traps. But I'll leave them like under the refrigerator or under the sink or somewhere like that.
Excellent.
Generally, scorpions aren't too much problem. The one thing I will tell you is somewhere in your garden, keep a plant of comfrey, C-O-M-F-R-E-Y, comfrey growing.
Okay.
It's an herbaceous plant. And the sap from that will do better than anything I've ever found at taking the sting, you know, out of a scorpion sting or a wasp sting or the itch out of a fire ant bite. My friend Rhonda over at Rhonda's Nature's Way, she actually has comfrey compounded into a lanolin-based cream. I think it's called Trauma Comfrey Cream or something like that.
Okay.
I've got a tube of that in my medicine cabinet, but I also keep some comfrey close at hand because you just have these little issues every now and then. And an amazing thing about comfrey, if you ever have the misfortune, and knock on wood, I never have, but if you ever have the misfortune of a brown recluse bite, this is a spider bite which produces an ulcerated area. All the doctors can do is what they call abrade the tissue, which means they keep cutting and cutting and cutting away tissue, hoping that they get it all. My friend Dr. Kirby went through this about 2 years ago, and had an engineer at the radio station many years ago who refused to see a doctor, and he was just getting a big rotten spot in the side of his leg. But comfrey will do more to stop that than anything the docs can do. I got Dr. Kirby to start rubbing comfrey on that spot daily. Within 2 weeks, it had healed without a scar. It's just amazing. It's the only thing I know of that will take care of problems from that kind of traumatic spider bite. But it's just something good to have. Everybody lives in the country should have some. And if you can't grow the plant, be sure and see Rhonda for some of the cream.
I just wrote Rhonda down because I figured I'm not going to be doing it now, so I need to get that.
So, as usual,
Bob, you do an incredible service to people and our community and everything else, and thank you so much for what you do.
Well, I get to talk to the nicest people out there, Debbie, and you're one of them. So you get out and have a good Sunday and enjoy your new home in the country.
Okay. Yeah, and it's not new. It's also old. Not as old as yours, though.
It's still the quiet nights and starry skies.
Beautiful. Oh, my God. The most beautiful sunrises and sunset. Waking up to nature, I feel like I'm living just this side of heaven.
But just to keep it between you and me, we don't need everybody in the world to move out there and make it any more crowded than it already is. Glad you're enjoying, and we'll talk again. Don, I'm going to get a quick break in here, and then we'll be talking to Susan next, and I get to talk about Southwest Metal Roofing Systems, which is near and dear to my heart as well, and even visited with my friend Howard Garrett yesterday. He doesn't have a metal roof on his home yet. I wish they had Southwest Metal Roofing Systems in Dallas, but I can tell you, if you're tired of dealing with shingles, dealing with leaks, dealing with roofers, dealing with insurance companies, get a Southwest Metal Roofing Systems roof and stop worrying. I did the same probably close to 20 years ago after we got an inferior quality metal roof on Shades of Green before we knew about Southwest Metal Roofing Systems. We put up with a roof that rusted out, rain damage, things like that. Then we call Southwest Metal Roofing Systems. They put on the best roof you've ever seen. We've been through hailstorms, windstorms, much, much, much rain. Only time we ever called them out was when a truck ran into the edge of the building and did a little bit of damage to our beautiful Southwest Metal Roofing Systems roof. Very energy efficient. They'll save you money on your utility bills. Insurance company knows how good they are, and they'll probably give you a discount on your homeowner's insurance. Plus, you get a beautiful roof that just is going to be there for as long as your home is there. Learn more. Give them a call, 210-822-6868. That's 210-822-6868 for Southwest Metal Roofing Systems.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, let's get back to gardening on just a nice Sunday morning. Hope you're having a good Sunday. Hope it turns out to be a wonderful day for you. And hope you get to spend a bunch of it outside. Let's talk to Susan right now. Good morning, Susan.
Hello.
Hi there.
We are a company to come and trim our trees in our yard.
Okay.
We're getting too big and...
Okay, your phone's cutting out a little bit. You're having a company come and trim the trees in your yard?
Yes.
Okay.
Say that again.
Your phone was cutting out on you. I heard that you had a company coming to trim your trees and didn't hear anything after that.
Oh, I'm sorry. They did a real good job on almost everything. But they cut the magnolia tree way back. I didn't want them to even touch it. And they cut like half of it away at the bottom, to about 8 feet up or maybe more. And I think it looks horrible, and it was beautiful, and it had beautiful blooms on it. And anyway, I was real, you know, upset about it because I did not give them permission to do that. And I talked to them about it, but they said, the guy that I talked to said it was what he was supposed to do. And I don't think I agree with that, and I've been trying to figure that out by reading. But
yep.
I'm wondering, is there any way that those branches can grow back, or is there anything I can do to help that tree now to survive?
Well, and the answer is sort of no, yes, and yes. Because the lower part of that tree doesn't have much light coming through, you're not likely to have new branches sprout out there. What will happen in the case of a magnolia tree is that the branches above it will grow out and will hang down and will gradually fill that space in, but it's not going to be new branches coming out of the trunk. And I would never hire this company again. I would diss them on Neighborhood or whatever apps you use. They obviously are idiots and don't know anything about magnolia trees. But the one thing that you do need to do for your magnolia, and because the way the magnolias have that low growth, because their roots need to stay cooler, needs to be shadier underneath the tree. And that's why I always tell people, if you're going to have a magnolia, you're going to have to give up the space underneath the tree, because those limbs need to be close to the ground. Since these idiots took the limbs away, what you need to do is be sure that you keep two or 3 inches of a good mulch. Doesn't have to be necessarily anything fancy or expensive. It could be the stuff you get at the brush dump, or if you want to buy a little bit better mulch, you get what we call a living mulch that has some compost mixed with it. Now, you don't want to pile this right up against the trunk, but you pretty much want to cover up all that area underneath the spread of the branches just to do the job that those branches were doing on their own. The tree's going to be fine. The health of the tree, as long as you can keep those roots cool, it's going to continue to grow. It's going to continue to bloom. The limbs above will gradually hang down and fill in that space, but just don't get me started on the hack, whack, and stack tree trimmers out there, because there are sure lots of them.
Now, should I water it more than I have been?
No.
It was real healthy.
Yeah. No, you continue to care for it exactly the way you've cared for it in the past. If anything, you can water it a little less, because it doesn't have as many leaves to use the water. So don't change a thing on your care. You're doing it right. Other than mulch, you don't need to do a thing.
Well, I know I can't believe everything I read on websites, but several of them said that.
Yeah. Susan, I'm going to get Don to put you on hold, and we'll talk a little more. This is KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right. Let's get back to the phone calls and gardening. Going to visit just a little more with Susan, and then it'll be Omar, and then it will be Roger. So, sorry, Susan, I have to get out right on the second for that news break. So I was very sorry to cut you off there, but let's keep going.
That's okay. Well, what I was saying is, I don't believe everything I read on websites, but several of them said that if a magnolia tree, and it's an evergreen, by the way, if they're cut back too much, that it can make them not survive, and it takes a couple of years to find out if they're going to survive. Is that true?
You're very wise not to believe what you read on the internet. The way that I would explain it, and it applies to, you know, many more trees than magnolias, if you take off too high a percentage of the branches, if you take away too much of the foliage on a tree, you know, it can cause problems. But now, if this is if they trimmed away 10% of the branches on the tree, you don't have an issue in the world. If they trimmed away 80% of the
it was about 50%.
Okay, that's, yeah, we're sitting on the borderline there. With your good care, the tree is going to be fine. But again, these apparently were just total idiots doing the work. And that should never have been done. But with good care, again, you know, so many people are maintaining their yard with the synthetic chemicals and things like that. And that's just kind of living on drugs. And if you get a severe problem, then you're going to have a lot worse problem than if, you know, things are going naturally. And so I'm not concerned about you losing your trees, your tree. Like I say, the mulch is going to help a great deal. I doubt if it's really to the point we have to worry about sun scald on that trunk. If this was the middle of July or August, I might tell you to wrap the trunk with something just to keep the hot sun off. We just have not had a lot of hot sun this year. By the time we do, the tree will probably have adapted. So the secret to how well your tree is doing is always going to be the new growth. So keep an eye on the top of the tree, keep an eye on the tips of the branches. As long as the growth that comes out there looks healthy and good, then, you know, we have no cause for concern here. Again, you want to be careful not to keep things too terribly wet, because when you take away that much of the foliage, you're taking away the tree's ability to use the water. The thing that makes the soil get dry is not evaporation. It's water being taken up through the process of transpiration, and all of a sudden your tree is able to only transpire 50% as much moisture. So you may need to adjust your watering, but beyond that, if you want to give it a little shot in the arm, get some Super Thrive. It's some of the most amazing material I've ever seen, and it's in some of the hokiest packaging I've ever seen. But it really does work as an anti-shock product. You could make up, you know, when the tree needs water, and it certainly doesn't need it now with all the recent rain. But when it needs water, you could do, you know, a couple of 5-gallon buckets of water with just, you know, a couple of caps full of Super Thrive in each one. That's going to minimize any shock. But the main thing for
you.
Any good nursery comes in a little brown bottle with a yellow label, and I tell you, you read it, it looks like snake oil, but it sure works, and that's a whole other story. But the main thing I'm concerned about is, you know, the summer sun and that soil underneath the tree getting too hot. That's what your mulch is going to take care of. Okay. So let's just call it lesson learned. I think probably 2-3 years from now, the tree's going to look beautiful again, and you won't have any further concerns.
If some little shoots grow out, should I cut it on the trunk? Should I cut them off or leave them?
That's totally up to you. I would probably leave them as long as the top of the tree looks good. I don't think you're going to see much of this, though, because the tree, in its own way of knowing things, which is, you know, not conscious thought, but certainly biochemical, shall we say, but it senses that there's no light there, so the tree is saying to itself, why should I put on leaves when there's no light down there? So not likely to be much of an issue. If they do, sure, I'd leave them. I'd let them grow, but it's not ever going to, you know, have the same branch structure that it once had.
Okay, what about fertilizer? Should I use anything, or?
Use the same thing you use on the grass. Good organic product, Medina, Nature's Creation, Maestro Grow. Nothing special. I know they make all these synthetic formulations, they say, for acid lovers like magnolias. No. Medina's Growing Green, Nature's Creation's Premium Lawn Food, Maestro Grow's Texas Tea. Your magnolia will love any of those diets.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You are certainly welcome. I appreciate the call and appreciate the opportunity to talk about important subjects. Omar and Roger are my next two callers, and Omar is first. Good morning, Omar.
Bob, how you doing?
I'm off to a good start today. How about you?
Oh, pretty good. I was pulling weeds in the garden, and I'm noticing a little bit of what is the Epsom salt water ratio that you use? I need to put some out for my tomatoes.
2 tablespoons of Epsom salts to a gallon of water. If you're going to put it on that way, the other thing you can do is just throw it on dry and water it in, but you probably don't need to do much watering right now. So, do it whichever way. But if you're going to mix up a watering can, 2 tablespoons Epsom salts to 1 gallon of water.
Gotcha. I've never done it to peppers, but I've heard people doing it to peppers don't need it, do they?
They don't really need it. It's not going to hurt anything, but some plants like roses really benefit from it. In that case, obviously, it's not blossom end rot on a rose, but it certainly will improve their color and improve their vigor in a lot of cases. So it's not going to hurt anything, but they're just a handful of plants that it really will benefit.
Gotcha. And I know it's the wrong time of year, but I'm just still taking notes. You know, our yard is very uneven. It's bumpy, really. I've been mowing a lot here lately. And it's mulch that you throw on there, and that's
no. Even out? No, what I would do if I'm trying to level it up, I would get a product which most places call lawn dressing or top dressing. It's a mixture of usually a petite red sand with some good compost, and that'll level it up very quickly for you and overall be very good for the entire lawn. But things like mulch and compost tend to rot away fairly quickly, and you're right back to that uneven surface. That mixture of your red sand and compost will bring it up level and keep it level for you.
Okay, with lawn, it's called lawn dressing or what?
Some companies call it either lawn dressing or top dressing.
Okay.
Most of my stuff from Stone and Soil Depot, I'd have to ask Jeff or Courtney or whoever which name they have it under these days. But basically, it's a mixture, pretty much half and half. They normally use a petite red sand just with a good quality manure compost, and best stuff out there for leveling up an uneven yard.
Gotcha. All righty, sir. Well, I appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate the call. Hope you have a wonderful Sunday, Omar. Thanks for calling.
You too. Yes,
thank you. Goodbye. All right, next up, and by the way, I do have a couple of open lines. If you're getting a busy signal earlier, I think a lot of folks have run off to church, so a little easier to get through at 599-5555. Roger's up next. Good morning, Roger.
Yes, Bob. Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
I know people tell you that it's nice to be able to call you, and you probably hear it so much you don't realize it, but we really do appreciate it.
It's a pleasure to get to do it, and I don't know, I just been doing it for years. I love gardening and I love gardeners, so glad to be here for you.
Appreciate it. Two questions. First, I'm not sure what the grass is. I know one doesn't grow in the shade and the other one does, it's real green, except I've started getting yellow spots probably the last 6 weeks.
Okay.
And the spots are getting bigger and bigger.
Okay. I want you to get down, you know, on your knees probably, and lift up on some of those yellow leaf blades. If that leaf blade pulls away from the runner underneath and it has kind of a little brown watery area where it joins the runner, that's going to be brown patch fungus, and there is some of it around out there. And you will cure it completely with nothing more than whole ground cornmeal. If the leaf is firmly attached to the runner, then it's probably just a little bit of nutrient deficiency brought on by, all of the rain. And it's time just for, another good dose of fertilizer, which will slowly take care of it. But if the yellow blades do pull away from the runner, then we're looking at brown patch, and that takes a little bit more effort to control it. But, again, it's not a real major thing. But if it's brown patch, you will want to take care of it pretty soon.
Okay. Appreciate it. The other thing is we, along our driveway, coming in the entrance, the rancher before had white cedar trees, and Harvey took care of them, and we replaced them with crepe myrtles.
Uh-huh.
There are several crepe myrtles on the place, but and they're now about 8 to 10 feet tall, and they're doing well. The only thing is every single one of them has a green fluffy moss all the way up the trunk.
It's called a lichen. It's a little interesting little plant fungus combination, totally harmless to the trees. Tells you you've had a pretty good amount of moisture, but look up lichen, L-I-C-H-E-N. They can be all different shapes. Some of them are yellow, some of them are gray, some of them are green, some of them are flat, some of them are kind of fluffy like you're describing, but totally normal little thing that's not hurting your crepe myrtles one iota. So that's one thing you absolutely do not need to worry about. The one thing I would do is I would check the base of your crepe myrtles, because so many crepe myrtles get to the nursery already buried too deeply in the pot, and you should see the trunk broadening. You should see the roots flaring out at the base, just like you would on an oak tree or an elm tree. And long term, your crepe myrtles will bloom better. Blooms will last longer. The plants will remain a lot healthy if that root flare is exposed. So that would be something I would check. But don't worry about your little lichens on the trunk. That shows that it's a moist season. And I think they're fascinating. One time I was clearing an area on the top of one of my hills, and I just thought I'd see how many different kinds I could find. And I think I found 15 or 16 different forms of lichen growing in the one area I was working on. But it's just one of nature's curiosities, and nothing's going to cause you or the plants any problems.
Okay. All right. I appreciate it, Bob. Thanks so much. You have a good day.
You do the same, Roger. Thanks for the call. Yeah. All right, Don, let's go ahead and get a break out of the way here, and we'll be right back with more phone calls.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, it's a nice day out there, and I tell you what, if you haven't been out to a good nursery lately, get out and do so. We were all pretty bare early in the season, because it just, between the freeze, between the damage to the growers, and the fact that the demand far exceeded the supply, there was a time that most nurseries around were pretty bare, but boy, that's really turned around. You're still going to have trouble sometimes finding a lot of your bigger trees and shrubs and such as that. But the nurseries are really getting back to where they're well stocked, especially with annuals and perennials, hanging baskets, and once again, just absolutely beautiful places to go visit. So if you're looking for something fun to do this weekend, there are a number of good nurseries around, and that would sure be a fun thing to do. Looks like the next three callers are going to be Teresa, Paul, and Jamie, and Teresa is up first. Good morning.
Good morning, Bob. Can you hear me?
Good morning. I hear you loud and clear. How are you today?
Oh, sorry. Everything survived from my freeze, except I have a Japanese yew tree, which
yes.
I had Tree Wiseman come out and they trimmed my oaks. That was one of your recommendations. But it's probably 8 feet tall, and the branches were green, and then mm-hmm. everything went brown. It does have a little green coming up from the very bottom of the tree. Some of them are dead because I can snap them off, and some of the limbs are still alive.
Okay.
But they're all brown, the whole thing.
Okay. What I would do is the brown portion, I would go through limb by limb, and I would trim them back by about half. The Japanese yew are one of the plants, and it's not like the northern yew. Don't confuse it with Taxus. This is something called Podocarpus. But Japanese yew, they suffered some damage, and they're one of the ones that the damage has been sort of late showing up. We've had the same thing on a couple of them we have planted here at the nursery. But the ones that are brown, I would take my pruning shears, I would cut them back by about half. Now, some of them are totally dead and they're not going to do anything, but the ones that still have some life in the limbs, cutting them back like that concentrates the hormones that make the little buds sprout and begin to grow. So hopefully this will stimulate some new growth, you know, in the mid to upper part of the plant. At the very least, the ones that are coming out down toward the base, I mean, your plant still had the root system of a big plant. The roots were not hurt by the freeze at all. And even plants where you've lost a lot of the top, that new growth coming out at the base is going to regrow, you know, five times as fast as it did the first time around, because you've got a big plant's root system and just a small amount of growth at the top. So I would definitely leave that lower growth, but I would take my pruning shears, and now I would go through and cut just all the limbs back about a third to halfway. We're going to leave them like that until the 4th of July. We're going to see which ones start coming out. pretty much anything that hasn't started putting on some new growth by mid-July, we might as well just go ahead and cut it all the way off because it is dead. And there are a lot of things out there. Loquats are one of the ones I'm really concerned about. They're going to look a lot worse before they start looking better. But at this point, your plant's going to survive. It's just going to depend how long it's going to take to come back and really be a big full plant. So leave the green stuff at the bottom alone. Cut back the top of it by a third to a half and go on with your daily watering and feeding and life as usual.
Okay, should I put Super Thrive or no?
It's always, you know, if you'll never go wrong with it, it's kind of like a vitamin and just it's and it smells a lot like B12, and so it must have a lot of B vitamins in there, and that can literally be a shot in the arm, to use a horrible pun, but it will help anything out there. Yes.
Okay, and just one more quick question. I also have a gardenia. I've had it for probably, it's in a pot,
uh-huh.
But it suffered a little bit. I did bring it in my garage and covered it, but it still suffered. So it's real uh-huh. tall and langly, kind uh-huh. of, but it did flower, not as much. But is there anything I hate to cut it back. I don't touch it because it's not my best. I don't see very well.
Pruning shears should be banned. You know, it's totally up to you. Once it starts putting on new growth, if you want to trim it back a bit just to encourage it to branch and fill in, you can. I would not do that until you start seeing new growth on it. But considering that this is a plant that is probably getting good light pretty much throughout the plant, it may very well start filling in the lower areas, whether you cut it back or not. So at this point, I'd just focus on giving it plenty of fertilizer, water thoroughly when it's dry on the surface, and I let it do what it normally would do. Gardenias don't grow real quickly, and they can be, I think they're better in pots than in the ground here for the most part, but it sounds like yours made it through the winter since you brought it in and took good care of it. Now it's just going to take a little time to fill back in again.
Okay, now I don't have to give it acid.
No, it's, just, you know, it's growing. And everybody always talks about what to do, but not the reason for it. It doesn't really work, in effect, to artificially give a plant some sort of acid, but gardenias like to grow in soils that have plenty of compost in them. When that compost breaks down, it produces what we call humic acids and fulvic acids, and these provide all the acidity that the plant needs. So don't be dumping vinegar or anything like that on it. That's not going to be much of a help, but you know, just good organic fertilizer. Since it's in a pot, I'd probably be using a liquid like some sort of fish product or has to grow plant or something like that.
Okay, great. All right, thank you so much. Thanks for all you do.
And no, it's my pleasure. And that Super Thrive you're going to put on the use, might you use a little bit of it on the gardenia as well? That'd sure appreciate it.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Teresa. Okay. Thank you. All right, Paul is up next. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Bob.
Morning, sir.
Good morning. My sister is growing tomatoes, cilantro, and peppers in a water trough, and her cilantro is not doing well at all, but the peppers and tomatoes are okay. Is it not draining right?
No, it's the wrong time of year. Cilantro is not a summertime plant. Cilantro is going to bolt and die no matter what you're growing it in, unless you happen to live in Northern California or somewhere like that. And what I tell people is, you know, when your basil dies, it's time to plant cilantro. When your cilantro dies, it's time to plant basil. Cilantro does beautifully through the cooler months of the year, but you could be the champion gardener of the South, and you're still not going to be able to grow cilantro in Texas in June and July. So it's okay. Not her fault or anything she's failing to do. It's just a wintertime plant, and it's starting to be summer.
All righty. Thank you. Listen, I got a deal that when this freeze came, I don't know if anyone touched on this, but when this freeze came, I had a little bur oak tree. I guess this is about as thick as a pencil and about
okay.
a foot long. And I tell you what, Bob, that freeze didn't do nothing to that thing. It has got leaves on it. I cannot believe that. Little bitty thing.
Well, you know, it's there's something to be said for the vigor of youth, and also bur oaks are trees which grow much, much further north than this. It never even shivered. It just thought, oh, yeah, a little cool weather. That's fine. That's no problem.
It's
just one of those trees that is very, very resilient. I think some of those trees, and I really can't tell you the reason, I think they've come back better since the freeze than they were growing beforehand. So I'm glad it's doing well for you, but I'm not surprised.
Oh, well, I didn't know that, but good to know. Also, I had a Myers lemon tree. Now, that froze. Now, underneath the grab, I'm getting some real nice green stuff. It looks like some type of orange because it's got the thorns on the, or thorns or whatever they call
it.
How can I find out what kind of orange tree is that?
Well, if you want to look it up, it's called either sour orange or trifoliate orange. You will not want to eat the fruit. The fruit is very, very bitterly sour. It's a real strong rootstock. You've really got two choices. There's no reason to grow that for the oranges. You will not get anything edible out of that. If you want to let the rootstock grow up, you can regraft it. In fact, if it's got four stems, you could put a lemon on one, a lime on the other, a tangerine on the third one, and a kumquat on the fourth one. That would be one option. But it's never going to go back to producing lemons. So unless you want to go to the effort of regrafting it, probably just need to look around for a new lemon tree this summer.
Great. How are the nurseries? Do they have more citrus now?
Not much. We got a couple of weeks ago, we got 100 plants from a nursery that originally said we weren't going to get anything till midsummer, and boy, they were out of here in about 3 days. You can call around. If anybody's got any, it would be Fanix, but when I talked to Mark the other day, they had not gotten any more. Our citrus growers are telling us midsummer we'll probably be getting more in, but as you've heard me say, a citrus sold in Texas has to be grown in Texas, and everybody lost citrus this year, and we've only got a couple of growers that are certified to grow here. So citrus is going to be in short supply for a while, but just call around, keep calling around. Hopefully by midsummer we will see more. Lemons, to me, the only lemon worth growing is a Myers lemon. If you want a more compact plant, you can look for one that's growing on what we call flying dragon rootstock. You want a standard tree, the same rootstock you've got there, which is probably either trifoliate orange or sour orange. It'll grow a good tree, but like I say, if you're in a bigger hurry, if you know somebody whose lemon tree survived, it's not all that difficult to regraft when that rootstock gets up a little bit bigger. So you've got a couple of different options, Paul.
Okay. Because most of my neighbors, they had the Myers, and one neighbor, I think his survived, but it was a real nice bushy Myers tree, but I guess it is a little more hardy. So I might have to talk to him about it and see if I can get something.
Yeah, bribe him with some of those fresh tomatoes. That ought to work well.
Thank you, Bob. You have a good weekend.
You too, Paul. You too. Thank you so much.
Bye.
All right. Looking at the time. Don, let's get a break done, and we'll talk to Jamie first when we get back.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. It's going to be Jamie and Kathy and Sandra are my next three callers. Jamie is up first. Good morning, Jamie.
Well, good morning. How are you?
It's a beautiful morning out there, and look forward to getting out in it another hour and a half or so. So for South Texas, this is just not bad when it comes to June weather.
I'm telling you, I'm getting some extra canning done with all this cool.
Very good.
All right. Snowmageddon did not kill my poison ivy or my Johnson's grass or the briars.
I'm into that. The bad stuff never goes away, only the good. But, again, Johnson grass is the easiest one to get rid of because Johnson grass has to grow tall. If you can be very, very conscientious about keeping it mowed off, every time it starts to grow up, you mow it back down, it'll just fold up and die on you. It has to grow tall in order to survive. Poison ivy and briar are, another issue. The way that I deal with them, and they're just not an easy way to get rid of it, but poison ivy, I start by cutting it off at ground level because, you know, that vine can be halfway up a tree. But I'll cut it off at ground level, and then when it sprouts out, I'll spray it with vinegar and orange oil. I'll cut it back again. Usually by about the third or fourth time, it stops coming back. My gate into my property, I used to have the biggest thicket of poison ivy there. This spring, I've got one tiny little straggler coming up, and I put the pruning shears in the car. It'll get whacked off probably this afternoon on my way home, so it will eventually die out. The briar, properly called smilax, that stuff is just a pain. If you've ever tried to dig it up, it's got this big, gnarly, underground, massive growth. And a lot of ranchers that I know that have had a problem with it have gotten a few goats, and the goats eventually chew it down enough that it quits coming back. I just keep cutting it, and it's like the poison ivy. Eventually it gives up, but it takes a lot longer. If you wanted to try to dig it up, you could get most of it, but there's not a product out there. You can deal with the worst chemicals in the whole world, and you still won't kill it. Now, out on pasture, out along a fence line or something, yeah, you can kill it with diesel or something like that, then follow that up with molasses to clean up the diesel. But in the yard, it's just a pain in the grass is what I usually call it.
Okay, well, the neighbor that's going to redo my fence suggested we put a gate between our properties so that his goats can free range over here, too. So that'll work.
Well, long as they'll leave your other plants alone, that's just fine. But goats are... goats are interesting creatures, and I would not want them on my property long term, but for some reason they seem to really like that that stuff, and that's not a bad thing at all. So no, I think you got a good neighbor there.
Okay, they're wonderful. Okay, now the armadillo that is turning my just off the porch area into spent minefield, is that thing going to finally get run out of bugs and go away?
No. It it may even be making new armadillos. They always have identical quadruplets, and have seen a few of those weird little creatures around. But armadillos, once again, the secret is trap them and relocate them elsewhere. The thing about catching an armadillo, number one, you don't want to handle them. They can carry animal leprosy, not commonly, but that's one reason to keep your hands off the armadillo, so to speak. I guess I'm lucky as a kid. I can't tell you how many of them I caught by the tail and enjoyed taking somewhere else. But the armadillo is a dumb creature. It doesn't climb. And the way that I trap them, because there's no bait that they will really go after. But, I will, if I can figure out what area they're active in your case, the bed in front of your porch, I'll use two 2x6s. If it's out in the middle of the yard, I'll use one 2x6 up against a fence. But I'll turn it up on edge. I'll put the trap down at the end of it, and Mr. or Ms. Armadillo comes up and hits that board, and they just keep walking along it, and they walk right into the trap and catch themselves. And it's just figuring out what their normal pattern is. You've got to have a good, strong live trap, because those claws, those legs are very, very powerful. And but that's how you can go about. And sometimes it takes two or three times, especially in the middle of the yard, because you never know which direction the armadillo is coming from. But if I see one of them coming into my yard, I'll know where he comes in, and then he's going to turn right and walk right along this low concrete base my 150-year-old fence has, and I'll just set up that board and just guide him into a funnel, and he'll walk into the trap and get caught, and he'll go live at the large expanse of open land down the highway from me.
Okay, well, he's coming from the neighbor's yard. Uh-huh. I've got him on camp camera.
Okay. Well, just, again, take 2x4 usually works. 2x6 works better. But just stand it up on edge and, brace it so it's not going to fall over. And he'll walk up to it. It's kind of funny to watch him. And he'll walk up to it, and he'll turn one way or the other. And chances are he's going to turn toward that area that he's busy plowing for you. Mm-hmm. And he'll just walk right into that trap, and off he goes somewhere else.
Okay. Well, and the good side of it is I don't have any June bugs. I had one.
They, you know, I love your attitude. You know, there's a positive part of almost everything, and that's the best thing I've heard said about an armadillo this morning. So there's some good in the worst of situations. I love the story of the preacher that was talking about one of the less pleasant neighbors, and he said, well, he did one good thing in life. He died. So in this case, if he's keeping the grubworms away, at least he's accomplishing something out there. So anyway, you have a wonderful Sunday, and I'll look forward to visiting again, Kathy.
All right. Take care, hon. Bye.
You're welcome. Thank you. Bye. All right. I guess we better get our last break of the show out of the way, and we'll come back and take a few more phone calls and have a good fishing song.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
Well, I'm trying to learn how to multitask. So the other day, I went fishing for the first time at the same exact time as I went fishing for the last time. Checked them both off my list. Yeah, a friend asked me if I wanted to go fishing, you know, which is weird, you know. A guy would feel comfortable asking another guy to go fishing, but a guy would never feel comfortable asking another guy to do the same exact thing but leave out the fishing part. Hey, Charlie, I was thinking this weekend I could swing by real early, pick you up, take you out to this lake I know about. It's beautiful out there. Could watch the sun come up. The way that glistens off the lake in the early morn. Something I wouldn't want you to miss. And I figured we could just spend the day sitting real close together on a boat. You up to doing something like that with me?
Oh.
Can we try to kill something? Feels less weird if we're trying to kill something.
Hold on. So it's we've got a little fishing humor instead of a fishing song today. You're right. You very definitely did get us off on a little different tack there, but anything makes you smile is a good thing, and thank you. Let's get back and finish up with a little bit of gardening with Kathy and Sandra and Michelle, and Kathy is up first. Good morning, Kathy.
Hi, Bob. Good morning.
Hi there. Good morning.
I'm notorious for saving plants, cuttings, get put up, and hardwood, softwood. But when you use your perlite, how do you use that, and how much water is in there, and what kind of a container?
Okay, well, here's the thing about rooting cuttings. A plant forms a whole different kind of root in water than it does in soil. And so even though you can root many different plants, in just simply in a cup of water, those roots pretty much all die off when you transfer them to soil, and the plant has to start over making roots that are adapted to soil instead of water. Perlite is that granular, it's actually a volcanic product. It's heated to a high temperature, and it pops like popcorn. They actually invented it to make lightweight concrete. But we'll take, a container that drains well. We'll fill it with perlite, put our cuttings in there, and then we water frequently. The good thing about the perlite is it holds enough moisture to let the cuttings root, but it also has a lot of oxygen in the perlite because it's such a loose, open material, so the roots that develop are roots that are adaptable to the soil. So we can then, once the cutting is rooted, we transfer it over to soil, and it goes through no shock whatsoever. So it's okay. Just, rooting in a different medium, and that's why we do it. And there's no such thing, because as you hear me say, water doesn't kill anything. Lack of oxygen is what kills plants' roots. Mm-hmm. So in a medium that is as open as perlite, you never have to worry about watering too often. In fact, one of my commercial growers growers that I see every week. For instance, they've got a propagation house that's like 150 feet by 150 feet, and they'll have just huge beds of perlite in there. They've got misters overhead that come on in the summer months, probably come on, you know, for 5 seconds, 20 times a day. But anyway, that's what perlite is. Perlite is just an alternative rooting medium, but it allows your cuttings, hardwood, softwood, any kind of cutting, it allows them to grow a root that can then be transferred to soil with no shock. So
very
that's
interesting. Thank you very much. Well, I appreciate it. Have a good day.
Well, you do the same, Kathy. I'm always interested in people who are interested in how the why as well as the how. So hope that helps you. Let's move along, and Sandra is up next. Good morning, Sandra.
Good morning, Bob. Do you mind if I use a speaker so I can type as you speak?
Well, you're pretty good. You're not causing us a lot of feedback, so let's give it a try.
Okay. I'm working with the Texas Science Education Leadership Association to provide input to the Texas Science Education Standards, which will be used to teach science to K-12 students. I'm working on the environmental science high school course. And there is nothing in the standards that relates to problems like using Roundup. So I have three questions for you. So I heard, I guess already this morning, about the soil microbes and the Roundup resistant weeds.
Right.
Are there any other impacts from Roundup other than those?
Well, Sandra, Roundup has been tied to a whole host of disease issues in humans and other animals. It's been related to child onset diabetes. It's been tied to Parkinson's. It has been tied to there's an article, and I would have to go looking for it, you know, in one of the medical journals, that it interferes with several metabolic pathways. And the, so to speak, the science behind Roundup, the reason Monsanto got it approved, is they said, well, it attacks a metabolic pathway that plants have. It's called the shimate, I believe. It's S-H-I-M-A-T-E. It attacks the shimate pathway, which plants have but animals don't have, and therefore it's safe for animals. Well, as you as a scientist well know, our gut bacteria, our flora in our gut, is really more plant-based, and the bacteria in our gut use the shimate pathway. So Roundup messes with your gut bacteria, and I mean, it's been tied to Crohn's, it's been tied to so many different diseases related to having, you know, a good healthy gut. And of course, as you well know, our immune system begins in the gut. So Roundup does mess with a lot of different things besides messing with the metabolism of weeds. That'll give you a good source for a little bit more research, and it'll scare the heck out of you too.
Yeah, I actually don't have to be very specific. You know, I could just talk about human pathways, et cetera.
Well, and it's been tied to a number of cancers. So, maybe I'm being a lot more specific than I need to, but people come and ask me why and say, prove it. And so I probably give too much information instead of too little.
Not to me, though.
And you just thought you were retiring. You're working harder now than you did teaching college classes, probably. So does that get question number one taken care of?
Number two, are there any other agricultural chemicals that act like Roundup or have similar impacts?
Oh, there are some that are worse than Roundup. There are some of these ones that we call synthetic pyrethroids, and the impacts that they have are numerous. Most of your broadleaf weed killers, most of your 2,4-D type products, are absorbed through the skin, and they have been tied to quite a number of different cancers. Your 2,4-D type products have been tied to hemangiosarcoma in animals, and various human diseases. They're usually worse in pets than they are in people. because our dogs and kitties run around barefoot, and so they absorb them through the pads on their feet. In fact, Dr. Kirby says when he sees some of these many times fatal cancers, the first thing he asks the people is if they use weed killers and things in the yard. And so 2,4-D is at least as dangerous, and 2,4-5-T, one of the related products, is Roundup is, but it has a different mode of action. There are others. There are herbicides such as what we call the sulfonated urea herbicides, like picloram, that are not broken down by anything in nature, so they remain in the soil for years. They get into the plants, and then the animals eat them. The material passes through the gut of the animal, and all of a sudden we've got a manure that is full of this herbicide, and its claim to fame is that it supposedly doesn't hurt grass but kills everything else, and that's why it's so widely used on hay crops. But it's something that is simply not broken down. Most everything in nature, including some radioactive things, there are things in nature that will take care of it, but this group of what we call SU herbicides, nothing in nature takes care of them. The other, and I'm trying to remember the name of the guy, I heard him on a TED talk talking about some of the other herbicides, and in that case, actually, they're insecticides that mess with sex hormones. And where these have been used primarily in Florida and some of the swamp areas, we're finding amphibian populations which are all female. No males. And in some other cases, they're all males and no females. It messes with a whole group of organisms out there in nature, and as many scientists will tell you, your invertebrates will tell you how healthy your environment is. And some of these things just wreak havoc. I'm trying to remember this guy's name. I don't know. You might Google TED Talks. He's quite a scientist, quite a well spoken individual. I heard him speak one time, and just a really neat guy. But look at the TED Talks and see if you can find his. I'll probably think of it, and if so, I'll give you a call. But anyway, those are, hopefully that'll give you enough. Sandra, let me go ahead and get Michelle in here. You know where to find me if I can help you any further. Thank you so much. Good morning, Michelle.
Hey, good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
Michelle, and I had a question about, and probably you've already answered this at one time, is the rosemary bush. I had a huge one, and it froze and killed most of it except a branch at the base of it. What would you recommend?
Replace it. Sadly, rosemary, especially the freeze, seem to be harder on the big ones than on the little ones. And unlike a lot of plants, the rosemary has a natural lifespan of somewhere between 8 and 12 years. I suspect yours is 6 or 8 years old if it's that big. And most things, I tell people, give it a chance to regrow your rosemary. You're going to be a whole lot better off just to plant a new rosemary.
Rosemary, okay. And so even the branch at the bottom, just cut that out too?
Well, it's up to you. If you've got room, cut back the dead and then just plant another rosemary in next to it. That one branch is probably going to die out in the heat of the summer. But if you want to leave it and just plant a new one next to it, nothing at all wrong with that. Do keep in mind that there are two different kinds of rosemary as far as growth habit. We have our upright rosemary, which actually is a little more cold hardy, but it'll make a bush that's 5 or 6 feet tall. And then we have what we call the spreading or prostrate rosemary, which spreads out. There are varieties which may get a couple of feet tall. There's some that really hug the ground and don't get over about 6 inches tall. But when you replace, be sure you're getting the kind of rosemary that you want, because if you want to, excuse me, if you want a spreading one, you definitely don't want the upright one. But if you want one that's going to spread and trail over a low wall or something like that, absolutely. Look for Huntington carpet or just one of the other good prostrate varieties.
Okay, so you said no to the upright
and get the spreading?
Oh, no, you get whichever one you like, but just be sure you know which one you're getting. And if you want an upright one, be sure you get an upright one. If you want a spreading one, be sure you get a spreading one, because if you're not careful, they look a lot alike. But just be sure you get the one that fits the growth habit you're looking for.
Okay, so the one that is better with cold temperatures is which one?
Is the upright. Is the upright. It will handle cold better, but people with real discriminating taste, the chefs will tell you that the prostrate has a little bit better flavor. Many of us can't really tell the difference, but if you're growing it mainly for barbecuing and cooking chicken and things, probably you want the prostrate.
Okay, and you said the Roundup is linked to a lot of health issues.
Yes, ma'am.